tonight on Arena. Caroline Byrne and Ruth McGill on Dancing at Lunasa at the Gate, and Aina Hardwick on his new film, The Sparrow. The Sparrow is a tragedy set in West Cork, focusing on the relationship between a father and his sons, and one lie that spirals out of control. It won the Best Irish First Feature at the Galway Film FLA back in 2022. Now it's back for a cinematic release. I'm joined by director Michael Kennerans and BAFTA-nominated actor Aina Hardwick, who plays Robbie, the on-screen elder brother of Kevin, who is played by Ollie West. Michael and Aina, you're very welcome to Arena. So, Michael, it's you're drawn to myth, but this is quite a biblical story, isn't it?
There's an element of Cain and Abel, I suppose, about the story. Yeah, I guess that's my work. I try to find some sort of mythic or that sort of deep story underpinning. I think it really helps with cinema. I think you're always trying to find characters or stories in contemporary world that pluck that collective unconsciousness feel, and I think that really helps.
So bring us into the story.
Well, the story is set in West Cork, contemporary West Cork, and it's the story of the Coyne family, who have basically a black sheep in the family called Kevin, who's a sort of 16-year-old teenager who's a bit of a wild kid. And then there's a golden boy, the older brother, who is Robbie, who Aina plays remarkably well. And they have... they're sort of living in the shadow of a deceased mother, who, and their father, Larry, is an ex-army and works down in the Oran Ali down there. And basically, you know, he has never really dealt with the grief or what he considers the shame of a sort of an original sin that happens. And he's kind of an old Abrahamic kind of father, I suppose. He's old school. And Kevin sort of struggles within that environment. And the film's about kind of him trying to break the silences within that household, where, you know, while also trying to have fun around West Cork in the summertime, you know, so it's not all doom and gloom either.
No, and it's so beautiful, West Cork. You're from Cork.
Cork City, but West Cork's a big part of my childhood, definitely.
So that must have been nice filming there, was it?
But it was a dream, actually, to get to do something there.
Now, your role, Aina, is Robbie, the golden boy, in terms of the father's love. You do what the father wants you to do. You're the kind of ideal boy. You go into the cadets. And the tension between you and your brother, played by Ollie West, Kevin, there's conflict. But in fact, the conflict comes because you're trying to help him, and the only way you know to help him is by conforming to the dad's worldview.
Totally. But it's a lovely relationship to play, that brotherly relationship, because it just takes in such a wide kind of breadth of conflicted emotions and competition as well.
So let's listen to a clip. In this clip, we have Robbie's fate is sealed. He's been accepted into the cadetship to become a pilot. Kevin, played by Ollie West, is in this clip, and we can hear his father, Larry, played by David O'Hara, and his aunt Grace, played by Aisling O'Sullivan, and little sister Sally, played by Michelle Gleeson.
I'm not one for speeches.
Thank Christ for that.
Amen.
I just wanted to say that I'm really proud of you, son. Well done.
Nice day. Thanks. Mum would have been proud too.
Well, she would have, Larry.
Can we drink now?
Yes. To Robbie.
To Robbie!
To Robbie! To Robbie!
A clip there from The Sparrow. It really shows all the different tensions there is in that household when they're trying to have a celebration.
Yeah. I think I'm the youngest of seven kids, so I'm probably at the end of those generations of large Irish families. But the dinner table scenarios and the conflicts are very recognisable, I suppose, when you come from big families.
Yes, and Michael, you know, Kevin and Robbie, we see the two brothers, one conforming to save himself, I guess, and Ollie acting out his grief. Did you write that from your own imagination, from two sides of your persona?
I guess there's an element of both Kevin and Robbie being two sides of myself at some level. Yeah, there was definitely, as a teenager, I was a little bit wild and you know, getting kicked out of school, and my dad was a guard, so that obviously helped in many ways, but also was a source of tension, shall we say. And yeah, but also I was, you know, there was a part of me that was good in school and was, you know, there was the saint and the devil side of it. So yeah, I definitely tried to think about those things, but also in terms of my older brothers, how they'd dealt with me, you know, those kind of conversations like, Jesus, would you just wind it in, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's very much from, there's a lot of personal stuff in there. Yeah, sure.
Okay. And could you identify from your own family with it?
Second youngest of seven. Mm. So we weren't far off. And we had loads of conversations about that. You know, Ali, David, myself, Michael, it was like that. It's all relative, actually. You know, you can be both, you can feel like the younger brother and the older brother, depending on the period of life, you know, your life you're in. And I really got that sense of just wind your neck in and make life easier on yourself, being the kind of Robbie's message. But I mean, Ali is the most, I mean, he's a phenomenal actor, as you know, anyone who sees the film will see. But it was really easy to fall into that dynamic with him and to find different shades in that, because I was watching him every day going, I'd kill for what he has.
He's amazing. Were you working on the script alone, or did you rehearse? Did Michael rehearse you?
We didn't rehearse much, did we? We kind of we had lots of conversations in advance, and then I think a lot of that rehearsal is almost like just hanging around in the days before the shoot and getting to know each other and getting very comfortable, so that you don't feel like you're walking on eggshells around each other when you actually film these difficult scenes.
Yeah, certainly for me, I like to just, you talk to people and talk to the actors and really just, you discuss, everyone gets on the same page with what the scenes are about and what the character's about. And then I don't like to overdo things in terms of, you know, working scenes to death and stuff. And I think it's better off let it happen in the day and keep it fresh, and everyone's a little bit more organic then. I think it really helps.
That's great, yeah.
I would think this is an unusual role for you. Like, people, you know, you're usually not the reliable, the best boy in the family.
Yeah.
Was that refreshing for you to have this role?
That was definitely a big appeal, you know, a big part of the appeal I wouldn't see myself as the natural sort of, whatever word you want to call Robbie, I guess the alpha golden boy, kind of the quarterback, as you used to say, you know, that definitely didn't feel, you know, like what I normally get cast as. So I was really excited to try and get that and capture that. And it was a breath of fresh air, definitely.
Yeah, because he is in conflict with the father. Like, he doesn't want to really go into the cadetship, does he?
No. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about when I read it was that in such a relatively short space of time, you get so much kind of internal conflict, actually, that the, you know, the story is this family drama about this grief that hangs over them all and many other things. It's also, you know, Kevin's story of, it's his summer holidays and just kind of the liberating excitement of that. But also that within that, there's always little counter conflicts, you know, that actually maybe he isn't the all-star quarterback that we think he is, and maybe it isn't all so cut and dry and straightforward for him. And that was the draw, actually, was that it was just, there was always, you know, just when you thought you had a character kind of pegged for, you know, what they are, they surprise you and they contradict themselves. And he's full of self-doubt and all of those things that I guess most 18-year-olds are going into the world.
Yes, because Michael, there is the character of Sally, and she seems to be such a genuine character, a character that the audience, I think, can identify with. And therefore she, you know, we kind of get from her that both boys, you know, are reasonable people, are lovely people. Sure. They're just caught in a difficult situation.
Sure, sure. I think that was really important to have that it wasn't just this male-dominated household. And in one sense, these themes are quite, you know, they're some serious and heavy stuff, but it's also, she brings such lightness to the household.
And David O'Hara as the father, and the father's role, I suppose he's on the biggest arch in terms of the character. Where do we find him at the beginning, and why do we find him as he is, which seems to be ungiving and you know, unsympathetic, particularly to the youngest character?
I think
his youngest son.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've always been interested in is the thinking about the the people you knew in school, and then you meet them in their 40s and 50s or whatever, and you're going, how do people become the way they are, and how do they wall themselves up in certain ways? And I think that that's very much Larry's thing, is just he's from a generation that couldn't deal with things like rejection or shame or those kind of things, and his reaction is to be as extreme as possible, to literally lock his wife's memories up in the attic and not allow his kids go up there. It's that kind of, you know, it's pathological kind of for him, you know. But I think it's because he is such a big-hearted guy. He has this kind of frailty and vulnerability that he has to go to that extremes. And I think that's what ultimately the film becomes about, really, is about him recognizing that and trying to find some redemption within that. You know?
Yeah, it is about masculinity, isn't it? And those kind of archetypes that you explored in Lakelands as well, that idea of trying to find your way as a young Irish man. Mm. And trying to be an individual while there are all these pressures on, let's say in Lakelands, it's about being the GAA star. Here it's about, you know, being manly and going into the cadets.
Yeah, I think there's a common theme in that, especially you do see it with Larry, with David O'Hara's character, is that, you know, there's how do you deal with an imperfect and actually, you know, tragic situation, or how do you deal with the kind of legacy of that? In a healthy way and move on. It's a really difficult thing, and I guess, you know, traditionally, like these stories are explored through, like, are these kind of explorations of masculinity are about how do maybe men cope or cope badly with these things. And I guess Lakelands, yeah, definitely had that side where it's how do you cope with a new reality? How do you cope with not being able to do the thing you've done for your whole life? And it was really interesting. I'd filmed them both within 6 months and wasn't really aware of the threads until after. You know, I think you're just trying to kind of focus on the character and focus on the story, and the thematic things only become aware, you know, you only become aware of them when you see them. And I saw The Sparrow in Lakelands in the same weekend, and it was amazing to see, actually, they're completely different stories, but just those common themes of, yeah, in this case, how do these blokes find a new way of living, you know, when the reality is shattered.
Really. Well, anyone who has seen either Lakelands or now The Sparrow, if they see you in The Sixth Commandment, they will go, what could be the connection there? That you were nominated for a BAFTA for your wonderful performance there as the con man and ultimately a murderer. How important has that role been for you, Ina?
Hugely. It was just a brilliantly challenging and satisfying job. And I think the storytelling, the way Sarah Phelps and Saul Dibb approached it, was something that would, you know, I was very new to me, and I thought a new way of approaching a real factual drama. I kind of can't thank them enough. It was a challenge from start to finish, but yeah, really proud of the piece of work, and got to go into work with Anne Reid and Timothy Spall every day, and that was no bad thing, you know. So,
and then I think around the same time you started rehearsals for The Cherry Orchard that you've just finished.
That was a while after. I guess these are the kind of, I was actually filming The Sixth Commandment when we were in Galway with this film, and so that was 2022. The Cherry Orchard was just finished up last week. So it's kind of been the last few months of my life. For something completely different.
And what was your character in The Cherry Orchard?
I played Yeppy Khodov, who's he's the accounting clerk. And to anyone who's seen, I suppose if you've seen any Chekhov, there's usually someone like him who's kind of not quite in the family, outside of things, unfortunate, clumsy, and in this case, clumsy and very funny, but also kind of a beautifully tragic comic character.
And fun to play?
Great fun. Great. I just got to go around and trip over the stage every night and do the two things that they say not to do. Don't trip over the furniture and remember your lines. I got to kind of do both.
And grow a tremendous mustache.
Thank you. Yeah. Listen, I mean, there's not many opportunities now to grow a great mustache. So I gave it a go. But yeah, it was lovely. I hadn't been on stage now in years, 5 years, I think. So it was such a buzz every night. Yeah.
Now, Michael, I'm sure you must be well into working on something else at the moment. What are your hopes and aspirations for The Sparrow?
For The Sparrow, yeah, it's just, I'd love for Irish audiences to come out and support it. It's, I think, obviously from a Cork point of view, we're really hoping to see lots of people come from Cork. But even, you know, in, I grew up in Mullingar, so I know there's the screening down in Mullingar starts tomorrow. Yeah, and just we want, I think it's a really emotional and dramatic piece of work that I think people will really get something out of from the cinema. I think it was made to be seen in the cinema.
Yeah.
I think it really sort of plays well there. So that's certainly the big hope at the moment, yeah.
Well, Aina Hardwick and Michael Kennerans, the best of luck with The Sparrow, and that's out in cinemas from Friday the 5th of July.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Set in the summer of 1936, Dancing at Lunasa depicts the lives of the five Mundy sisters, Maggie, Chris, Agnes, Rose and Kate, as they welcome home their frail elder brother Jack, who has returned as a missionary from Africa. The play is set in early August around the Festival of Lunasa, an occasion that ignites the centrepiece of the play when the sisters break free from their inhibitions and engage in a frenzied dance. That is the setting of Brian Friel's Tony Award-winning play, first performed in the Abbey Theatre in 1990. It was turned into a successful film in 1998, starring Meryl Streep as the eldest sister, Kate. The Gate Theatre are now reviving Dancing at Lunasa, and I'm delighted to be joined in studio by the director, Caroline Byrne, and the actor, Ruth Miguel, who plays the breadwinner of the family, the school teacher, Kate. And Ruth, you are from Glenty, so you're from the home of Dancing at Lunasa.
I'm from Ardrabb, which is 50 minutes over the road, but I went to school in Glenties, so my secondary school education was in Glenties.
Yeah. And you remember the screening of the film?
I do indeed. Yeah, they all came. Well, they didn't all come, but Meryl Streep was there, Brian Friel was there, and I forget who else was there. There was one or two more cast members. Yeah, and I was a 17-year-old, I suppose, or 18-year-old at that point. And I was offering a champagne to Meryl Streep as she came in to see the premiere of Dancing at Lunasa in our gym, you know, in that very kind
and
of parochial.
And here you way. Are playing Kate now.
Yeah, very, yeah.
And what did the people of Ardra and the Glenties make of the film? Did they love it? Were they happy
well,
with it?
Brian Friel is very important to Glenties in particular. Like, there is such great warmth towards him because I think of the way in which he paints the lives of Donegal people. Not many people do that. Frank McGuinness, of course, would as well. But I think they really deeply appreciate the ways in which he delves into the lives of people in the way that he does. And it's sort of an honouring of people from that area, I feel.
So, Caroline, if you would, bring us into the lives of the Mundy sisters as told through the eyes of Michael. So Michael is the son of Chris and he's an adult when he's telling this. So it's a memory play. But
yes.
Tell us about the sisters.
Well, I think the first thing to say is actually through Michael, they get conjured or manifest or we return back into the 1936 when he was aware that there was some kind of unease in the house. And that there was, he describes a widening breach between what seemed to be and what was. And I guess the Mundy sisters that we meet, they're presented in their fullness, in, you know, their anger and their joy, the threats that are there, but also the camaraderie and the spirit that they have as a community together. So we see kind of both parts of their lives, the sense of having duty and the sacrifices that they have made to keep this boy who was born out of wedlock and to fight for him to stay in that home with them and raise this young boy, which would have brought a huge amount of shame to the family. But also at the same time, we see that they've made this little life with the five of them in the house, they've made it work. You know, there's a self-sufficiency inside of that house where they're, while they're poor, they are actually able to survive. So we see both parts. I think that's what is so good about this play. It explores personal freedom, but also their sense of duty and also the kind of moral code that's, you know, handed down by the Catholic Church that they have they're trying to adhere to and live by, but also because of this pagan festival that's seeping into the soil and it seeps up through their feet, and it also allows them to be free at this moment in time. So he presents us this period in his life where transition and change was happening to his family, but also where they were at their most free because they were most in touch with the seasons.
So, Ruth, you play Kate, as we said, and Kate is the eldest of the family. She's the breadwinner. She's the school teacher. So she's very much in touch with the outside community. Mm-hmm. And of course, she loves her family, but she has to be quite strict because she has loads of worries about both Michael and other problems or issues within the family. Can you tease out some of those?
Yeah, I mean, there's... It's sort of the outside. We were even speaking about this the other day. It's like keeping the outside outside and not letting it come into the house, because already within the house, there's enough to balance as it is with the boy that is beloved and loved. But there is that situation. And for the outside world, what they think of that is very important, and what they think about anything but us is important to Kate, I feel. But also we have Rose, who's someone that we need to protect in another sense of the word, because she is an adult who is vulnerable. And there's a great kind of knowledge of that and of what might happen, or the fear of what might happen. So there's
in the outside world.
The outside world, because in here we will mind each other, but if we're not here, if it isn't the five of us, what? It's not even worth. You couldn't go there, you know, to think about that. I think for Kate, she can't.
And Caroline, if the whole situation wasn't fragile enough, into this then comes Father Jack coming back from Africa. He's a very changed man, and he's a very liberated man in many respects.
Yeah,
tell us a bit about Jack.
I think. You know, again, Friel brilliantly presents two things happening to in the play, in that Father Jack is actually their commodity in a way for respectability. He is going to bring back, you know, saying mass, bringing their status along in the community. So they invest a lot in him as a priest, but in some ways he's more useful away from the family out in Uganda than returned, because when he has returned, or when he returns to the family, he is converted to a very tribal way of life. And that life, you know, is quite at odds with the Catholic way of thinking. And he is, I think he's quite enlightened. He's quite at peace with having abandoned his faith and finding a new faith with that. That is about being in touch with the seasons, been in touch with many gods, sacrifices, ritual, and is actually very pagan at its heart. So I think Kate takes on the project of trying to convert him back to what he was. And the hope is that he will return to, you know, his senses.
Because
and
you're trying to keep it all together, Kate.
Yes, absolutely.
Sorry, Kate.
Exactly. And I mean, and there's also the want to do that is because of the outside world. But the tension comes from, well, I love, you know, this person is someone that she loves, but also wants to change, you know, and it's a hard thing to do to someone, to want to change them, even to, you know, to not let a person be how they are, because it's not accepted. It wouldn't be accepted. And it's dangerous, actually, for the family. And she knows that deeply, the repercussions of it.
Now, Caroline, of course, the centerpiece is the dance.
Yes.
And I think you went back to the man himself, to Brian Friel, to his notes.
I did.
Just to get some steer from him about what the dance is. Maybe just set up the dance and then tell us what you found from him.
Yeah, well, I guess when I was doing my research, I went to the National Library just to look at the notes that Friel had written about the production. And I was really surprised to find his notes on the dance, which said it was no fun, savage and Dionysian. And I thought, OK, that's quite different actually to maybe the way that it has been presented before, or maybe the way
it's like an outbreak of joy or something.
The idea of having no fun, I thought that was quite interesting. And actually, when you look at the stage directions of the dance, he does describe it as very grotesque, a dervish, order being subverted, and I think that that's the language certainly that we've tried to explore in the room. But there is a bit of fun in it as well. There is a bit of joy. But it was interesting. We were running it the other day, and I think I asked people to stop having fun, and it was just very interesting what that did to the release that it's giving the women and the corset coming off, the strain that they're all feeling, but also their freedom being allowed and the savagery, I think, that's in us all, that's presented on the stage.
And Kate, is your character Kate a willing participant in this, or is she a bit reluctant at the beginning because she has to be the straight-laced one because she's the respectable one in the community?
So is said so much about her, but I think within her as well, I think there's a question of should this be happening? Should it? It's not a. She's not saying no to it. At no point does she say actually no to this dance verbally, where she might do, you know, at previous moments in time. So I think her body says yes. Her head might be saying no, but the body is saying yes, yes, yes. And eventually she succumbs, I say.
And what did you think of Caroline's and Mr. Friedel's take on the dance?
That's actually, it's sort of how I was feeling about it as well, from things that I'd read about as well about the dance, and also what is dance to begin with anyway, and what is it but it's an expression of something deep within, and it's not always about joy. It can be, it can end up being that way, but sometimes it comes from something much more painful. And it's been such a beautiful challenge to work with this dance and all the layers that it's kind of showing of itself.
So Sue Mython, and I think Jean Butler had a hand in this as well.
Yeah, very fortunately, Jean Butler was in town for 2 days. She was flying in, and there was someone at the gate who knew her. So we invited Jean in to consult with us on the dance. So she came in and she did 2 days, which was really very special.
So Riverdance meets Dancing at Lunasa at last.
Well, actually, I think what's so beautiful about it is because obviously Irish dance is what she's known for hugely, but she actually knows Irish dance not as this just the steps, but as something kind of deeper and deeper. And that's what I kind of got from her, actually, was less about the steps and more about like why do we move in this way in Irish dance, and you know, the hands and the things that have come to be about that dance that we know about it. So it was a beautiful intermingling of the work that Sue Mython has been doing, because she was working from the inside of emotional qualities, and then working with Jean then was such a beautiful, it was a beautiful marriage of movement minds.
Well, it sounds tantalising. Dancing at Lunasa is at the Gay Theatre from Friday the 12th of July to Sunday the 21st of September. Caroline Byrne and Ruth McGill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Friday evening, so time to have a listen to this week's album releases. And we have three very different and perhaps divisive records, according to our reviewers, Pat Carty and Kellyanne Byrne. No Flowers Grow in Cement Gardens from A Lazarus Soul was recorded in France in just 4 days after a long period of separation for the band. Half of them live in Ireland and half in France. The current lineup has been together for 13 years and this is their third album together. Next is Happenings from Kasabian. The album promises big tunes and an attempt to capture the sound of their live shows. Last weekend they played to a packed tent in Glastonbury for their surprise set. But how do our reviewers feel about their latest offering? And finally, Into the Blue from multi-instrumentalist Aaron Fraser. It promises to be a daring blend of soul, psychedelia, spaghetti western, disco, gospel and hip-hop. I'm delighted, as I said, to be joined by Kellyanne Byrne and Pat Carty. But let's start with The Lazarus Soul and this track, Black Mariah.
Wow.
So Some call it Black Maria. Some call it Black Mariah. But it's the cold-hearted wagon that is taking civil liberties away. Some call it Black Maria. Some call it Black Mariah. But it's the cold-hearted system that is taking our resistances away. Tear-toy wrapped in taser, restrained by the blue blazers, to keep the poor opinions on their seats. Tear-toy wrapped in taser, detained by navy blazers, protecting those collecting property.
That's Black Mariah, or Black Maria. No Flowers Grow in Cement Gardens is from A Lazarus Soul. So, Pat, you first encountered A Lazarus Soul at All Together Now Festival.
Yeah.
What was it that attracted you?
I was wandering around. I was reviewing the day, so I was trying to see as much stuff as possible. And someone said to me, listen, go in and see this crowd, A Lazarus Soul. They were playing in one of the tents. And I was watching it. I was thinking, yeah, these guys are pretty good. And then they did a song, which is on the last album, called No Hope Road, which is about buying reggae singles off a stall. This is Brian Brannigan, the lead singer, and I thought, yeah, this is pretty good. This is good. And I listened to the record, and I thought, while it's not completely my thing, I could really appreciate that he's a really good songwriter, great lyricist.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and that album got a lot of attention, and then set them up for this one, which they took a while doing. And I think he kind of, Joe Chester, who's the guitarist and the producer, said that maybe Brian felt he was under a bit of pressure, but I think they've definitely... They've bettered it here.
Oh, absolutely.
Fantastic.
So, Kellyanne, let's talk about that track that we just heard there, Black Maria or Black Mariah. Is that fairly indicative of the album? It's hard political stuff.
I mean, it's a great opener. It's an explosive opener to this compelling record, is how I'd describe it. It's about police brutality. And, you know, they're known for being very socially aware. But actually, a lot of this record was inspired by nature and by Brian's walks along the Bog of Allen and the Royal Canal. He lives in Maynooth. So you've got this kind of wilderness of nature, but then you've also got the wilderness of human nature. And there's amazing characters in it. Like, there's one track called The Dealers, about two women who work on Moore Street, Tessie and Bridie. And it just blew me away. I cried every time I listened to it.
Yes, we'll come back to that one and actually play some of it in a moment.
Yeah.
But there's also one inspired by Marina Carr's By the Bog of Cats, that play, Pat.
That one I'm going to pass to my colleague.
It's the flower that I flung into her grave.
Is
yeah,
that what that one is? Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't aware of that. So
tell us about that one. That sounds...
out. Yeah, I think that was the first single released from the album. It's quite kind of Smiths-like, I thought. A lot of it inspired by nature. I mean, the lyrics, I'm going to just read.
Is that the one with the line that we are the catchers in despair?
Yeah.
What a line that is. If that was the only thing he wrote, that'd be reason enough for people who are listening to go out and buy that record this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, we grew up in special cases. We got our love of open spaces from our days upon the bog. And when the hours went to class on Monday morn, we danced like sparrows balanced on the corn in the early morning fog. That should be on Leaving Cert. I'm serious.
Yes.
Students should be studying this record. That's how good his lyrics are, his words
are. And this is, Brannigan is the lyricist who gets his inspiration from walking the Bog of Allen. Mm. And Kellyanne was talking about The Dealer there. Mm. The Dealers. Yeah. Tell us a little more about that, Pat.
Well,
I think you liked it as well.
As Kellyanne said, I think it's about Moore Street traders, you know. And it's about, I think in general, the gentrification of Dublin, and certainly the Dublin that Brian is a Finglas native, would have grown up with. But there's a line in it, and this is... language is a bit risque, so I do apologise in advance, where they talk about Philistines with hard-ons for malls and hotels. So he's talking about, you know, people building, we're going to end up with a town here where people come and stay in overpriced hotels just to go and look at other hotels, because there's not going to be anything else to look at. And that's basically what he's talking about. You know, and this was something that they covered before on Long Balconies on the previous album. But Brian is almost like a social historian of Dublin. You know, he's cast fixing his eye on what's going on here. You know, I know the Bog of Allen and all that, and he lives in Kildare himself, but I suppose he can look at it from outside. So, like, the Factory Fada is the other one that really stood out to me,
yeah,
which
me
is kind
too.
Of about abuse of children in school. Not abuse, but maybe violence against children in school, and then people being judged by where they come from, and then, you know, any effect of treating a child like that, send them down the wrong road. And he uses, you know, Francis Fitzgerald was his actual friend, who ended up, you know.
It's the characters, characters, you know, in the songs that are, they just literally dance. Yeah. They dance in your mind and your ears. And he brings these people alive with so much vigour and enthusiasm and empathy. I think that's one of the greatest things about this band.
Okay, well, let's listen to the one you both picked earlier. This is The Dealers.
Bridie and Tessie were out on their feet, selling knocked-off Reebok along cobble streets. Evenings brought sing-songs and the slagging from hell over the jeers and the gossip, a slow sadness wells. The road to the morning was measured in kegs, and all the lads claimed the girls had hollow legs as they'd speak of the future and what they might do, as though the night had the power to make it come true. Squirrel their money away. Change is the stranger to which we all pray. They dreamt of a gaff with a garden in a drum shambo terrace to stay.
That's some of The Dealers there from A Lazarus Soul. No Flowers Grow in Cement Gardens is the name of the album. Stars out of five for you, Kellyanne.
Oh, I'm breathtaking. This record is five. I would give this more. If I just 5 out of 5. It's unbelievable. Please, everybody, listen to this wonderful album.
Pat, equally enthusiastic.
I am, yeah. I should quickly note, it's not just a one-man show either. The music on this record is great as well.
Yeah.
I give it 4.75 because it's not my favourite record of all time, so I don't want to give it 5 out of 5, but it is very, very good. Everybody listen to this, go and buy this record this weekend.
Okay, A Lazarus Soul, that's No Flowers Grow in Cement Gardens. Kasabian are back with Happenings, their 8th studio album and their 2nd with founding member Serge Pizzorono, is that right, Kellyanne, as the frontman? Tell us a little bit about the frontman and the changing frontman.
Yeah, so he's the kind of lead songwriter with Kasabian and guitarist, and this is their 2nd release without their former frontman, Tom Meehan.
You say songwriter, that's kind of exaggerated, but go ahead.
I told you it would be divisive, I just didn't think they'd start so quickly.
It's their 2nd release without Tom Meehan, who was fired from the band back in 2021, I believe. On an assault charge against his partner. So this is their 2nd release. The last was called
The Alchemist's
Euphoria. And they've said it's inspired by dance music and their live performances.
All right, let's listen to A Darkest Lullaby.
Oh, my love. Never.
believe the guffawing that's happening over at the end of the desk here. That's Darkest Lullaby from Happenings by Kasabian. What, you're like two children.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like it, Pat.
Saying I don't like it is the understatement of the year. Actually, this record annoyed me. It was
not
so,
just that track, presumably.
Not just this track. I mean, first of all, there's so many things wrong with it. First of all, your man Serge, right? He's not. If you heard him singing in a bar, you'd be giving out. He doesn't have a voice at all. You can hear it there anyway. They have no ideas. There's no ideas in this. First of all, the album is about 28 minutes long. And I'd say they struggled to get to 28 minutes. There is
26,
there you go. Even worse. 2 minutes worse. I mean, right, one of the songs on it is called Algorithms, that tells us that algorithms have no soul. Well, Jenny, thanks for that, Serge. You know, thanks for pointing that out. You know, there's stuff like, I'm going to quote a few lyrics here. I love it when you call.
Makes no sense at all.
You know, which makes that algorithms thing sound like the Beatles, to be honest with you. You know, and if someone told you that call song was actually produced by AI, like they were given out in the previous song, you'd believe them. It's awful. I mean, what annoys me about this is that there's money been spent on it when there's, you know, 150,000 other bands who might have at least one idea.
I know, but Kellyanne, like the crowds fill the tent at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
I mean, look, somebody must love them.
Yeah, this is the thing,
right? I think avid Kasabian fans probably will love the record, and they said that they made this record for festivals, for people getting up on shoulders and all the rest of it.
Do you think it would work in that context?
No, but in that context, yeah, probably. I mean, I tried so hard with this. I tried. I did my workout to it. I cooked to it. I kept going back to it. What's wrong with me? But I just couldn't get into it.
Right. And no saving graces. Oh, okay. Nope. All right. We better go to Star. So for you, Pat, out of five?
I had given it zero, but I'm going to give it one because it actually made me feel something. It wasn't like the sea of mediocrity that's out there between the stuff I like and the stuff I hate. At least this got a reaction out of me. And maybe that's what they were trying to do. And if that's what they were trying to do,
fair play,
maybe they're geniuses and I'm just not picking up on it.
Well,
so
can you double one out of five?
One out of five. Don't play this.
Okay. So that's Happenings by Kasabians. I tried to defend it, but there's no point. Now we're going to Into the Blue by Aaron Fraser. Tell us about him, Pat.
Tell us about him. He was where I first became aware of him was he was the drummer, and I think he does a bit of singing as well with Duran Jones and The Indication, who are this soul band from America whose second album, their first album is very good as well, but American Love Call in 2019 was the one I thought was really good. And then this record kind of took me by surprise. I got a hold of it. I wasn't reviewing it or anything like that, and I was kind of playing it and thinking, this is really good. And then it got to the end of the year, and I was asked to vote in these albums of the year thing. And I kind of looked at it and thought, that's the record I've been listening to more than anything else. It's beautiful, beautiful soul record. You know the one, If I Got It, Your Love Bought It. There's a great, just one of the great songs of it. Anyway, this one was announced.
And Over You is brilliant.
All of it, the whole thing. This one was announced and I was delighted. And the first couple of singles of it, which are Payback, which is kind of this, it's got a Motown bass on it and Northern Soul drums and your man's falsetto. It's really, really good. And then even better again was the title track, which has got this kind of, as you mentioned at the start, got this kind of
Morricone
thing. It's like someone going down a dark alley of
love. Yeah, I think we should play that one. This is Into the Blue by Aaron Fraser.
Here I go with the world.
That's Into the Blue from Into the Blue by Aaron Fraser, and it's the second single off the album. So this is an album about heartache, isn't that right, Kellyanne?
Yeah, that's right. So he had broken up with his girlfriend of 5 years, and he decided to move to LA, from New York, which is why he wrote that track Into the Blue, because he said it was a very kind of strange time for him. He didn't know where he was going, but there was also excitement about all of that. So yeah, much of the record is about grief and loss, but then also possibility, because there's some tracks on it that are about new love too. And then this move to LA. I mean, even listen to that track. It's like...
It is very cinematic, isn't it?
It's so cinematic. It's got that Ennio Morricone. For me, that sounds like something out of a Tarantino movie. And I feel on this next record, the second record, he's just kind of shown us further how talented he is. Yeah. There's more genres as well. I think more, a bigger, a greater blend of genres. He's got psychedelia, 1950s and 60s soul, northern soul, R&B, gospel, hip-hop. It's hugely influenced by hip-hop too.
So. And Pat, were you, you picked out lyrics even in Kasabian's. So were you taken by the lyrics that Aaron Fraser gives us?
Well, you know, Take Your Heart and Dust It Off. And then the last song that's on it, The Fool, which I thought was really, really good, where he kind of, it's kind of lamentive about his own status as a sad boy who's loved and lost. With a record like this, trying to steer around your question because I can't answer it. I wouldn't take the lyrics out of it because it's got this overall sound that the Kellyanne's alluding to. Now, people might say, oh, well, it's kind of, that's like 70s soul, you know, Curtis Mayfield or Marvin Gaye, whatever. But it kind of goes past pastiche. Because of his talent.
He puts his own stamp on it.
Mm-hmm. He puts his own stamp. He's kind of stand up against those records.
Yeah.
We were talking about D'Angelo's Voodoo, which is a record from 2000, just before we came on, and how does the influence of that on as well, which was maybe one of the last great soul records, you know, and its hip-hop influence as well. This is fantastic. He's got the voice, great band, great musicians on this, and just great songs.
Yeah,
this
let's play really a little of Playback. That's a very different song then. Okay, this is Payback. That's Payback from Aaron Fraser. I think, Kellyanne, like that's a real dance, fill the dance floor kind of number, isn't it? And there's a few of those on the album.
There is, absolutely. I mean, we're all moving here in the studio. I think if you don't dance to that, you've no soul. It's got real Ike and Tina vibes, kind of Northern Soul, Stomper actually. A little bit like Overview from the last record. And then there's another track on this album called Easy to Love, which is quite disco influenced. So you've got the Philly Soul stuff, you know, the Temptations, Delphonics influence. And then you've got stuff like you just mentioned, Gamble and Huff influence. But I think he has his own stamp. It's like Duran Jones, Jalen and Gonda, Jungle, these bands at the moment that are kind of holding the flag for classic songwriting, soul songwriting.
I have that Easy Love down here written down here. It said, fill a dance floor faster than ABBA at a wedding.
Yeah, it's great.
And I said, Kellyanne, who is, you know, Ireland's grooviest DJ, will probably already have this in her set. So if you're at a festival and you want someone, you want to go and have a boogie for yourself, go and find Kellyanne because she'll be playing all this great and much more great stuff as well.
And then I'll drop a bit of Kasabian. I can jump on your shoulders.
Go to the bar, yeah.
Okay, stars out of 5 for Aaron Fraser. Poor old Kasabian will be mortal now when you give loads of scores to this guy.
4 from me.
4 for you, Kellyanne. And from you, Pat.
I would go for 4, 4.5. I think this is fantastic. And I think it's going to be something that I'm going to love even more in 6 months' time.
Okay, the albums are A Lazarus Soul, No Flowers Grow in Cement Gardens, Kasabian Happenings, Aaron Fraser, Into the Blue, and Pat Carty and Kellyanne Byrne. Thank you very much. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rosanwo and Paula Shields. Niall McMonagall was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Nessa McLaughlin. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.